This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living. I'm Lee Chui Lin. News headlines are often awash with medical researchers touting all sorts of numbers and all manner of theories proven or disproven. We get excited reading this, but how often do we think about the people who are actually behind these numbers? Not just the people conducting the research, but our quote-unquote, you know, human test subjects, so to speak. Today, I have the CEO of Cancer Research Malaysia, Professor Dr. Teo Soo Huang, in to talk about the impacts and ramifications of long-term clinical research. Professor Teo, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what kinds of clinical research does Cancer Research Malaysia conduct?
Well, at the moment, we're focused primarily on laboratory-based research. But a lot of our discoveries are starting to make it towards the clinic, and we really need to be thinking about how we make this applicable to cancer patients in this country. So, for example, we've launched our first national study on ovarian cancer. It's called the MAGIC study. Now, it's an acronym for Mainstreaming Genetic Counseling and Genetic Testing for Ovarian Cancer Patients. The objective of the study is very simple. We're basically, we know that 1 in 9 ovarian cancer patients have a germline mutation in BRCA1 or BRCA2, and this means that not only they have elevated risk of developing breast cancer, even though they already have ovarian cancer, but it has got ramifications for the rest of the family. Unfortunately, for most patients, they don't know that this risk exists, and they don't know what they can do about it. And unfortunately, in this country, there isn't enough genetic counselors, and therefore, this means that in the foreseeable future, we're not really going to be able to roll out services for cancer patients in this part of the world. So how are we going to do this? There are only 3 genetic counselors in the country and potentially 1,000 ovarian cancer patients in a year. This is just new ovarian cancer patients without even thinking about the ones who were diagnosed last year or the year before and so on. And you also need to think about services for breast and colorectal and prostate and pancreatic cancer patients and so on. So simply, it's not possible to be able to do this. But we can't just roll out and just have a training program and get doctors to offer services, because the recommendations are that genetic testing should only be ordered when appropriate genetic counselling is offered. So what we're doing in this clinical study is evaluating whether we can, through a training program, train oncologists, gynae-oncologists, and non-genetics-trained people to be able to offer genetic counselling, and then to compare with referring patients to a genetics clinic itself and to see whether this is equivalent. Why is equivalent important? Well, doing bioequivalent studies is very important because if you're going to introduce a generic, for example, you want to make sure that it's the same as the gold standard compound that was produced by the pharmaceutical industry. In the same way, genetic counselling, we know that's delivered by a genetic counsellor in clinical genetic service, is the standard gold standard of care. But how about if we train someone else to be able to do that? Will it match up with that gold standard? Until we do this study, we don't know. And if we now go out and offer genetic testing very widely in the population, it's got ramifications that patients and their families could regret. And if we don't do this properly, at the end of the day, patients are going to suffer.
And of course, you've been working with the mutations of BRCA1 and 2 for quite some time. Could you take us through your methodology? You know, how do you kind of gather numbers? What are the pieces of information that you're looking for outside of the MAGIC study?
Okay, I think that's a really good introduction to the history of what we've been doing here. So conventionally, people think about BRCA1 and BRCA2 as breast cancer predisposition genes. It's what is in the name, right? But we now know that you need to be able to understand who should this test be offered to. So in the past, we know that BRCA carriers tend to develop breast cancer at an earlier age of onset. They tend to have other members of their family that are also affected by cancer. So traditionally, we would have offered genetic testing and genetic counseling and genetic testing to individuals who develop early onset cancer as well as family history. But the challenge in Malaysia is that our population risk of cancer is changing dramatically. So these numbers and these methods really only applied in a Caucasian population. Does it apply in Malaysia? We didn't know. So to be able to do this, what we actually did was to set up a study. So you set up what is called a cohort study, and this cohort study we set up in 2 hospitals in University of Malaya as well as Sime Darby Medical Center. Over the past 10 years, we've recruited 3,500 breast cancer patients to this research study, and we have shown that if you use family history as well as age of onset to offer genetic testing to specific individuals, then 80% of the BRCA carriers will be picked up by stratifying this. What this means is that if you, rather than offering genetic testing to all breast cancer patients, if you only offer it to individuals that fulfill a specific high-risk criteria, this means only 1/3 of breast cancer patients, you can pick up 80% of the BRCA carriers. This is a cost-effective exercise. This is really important to get across, that genetic testing for BRCA1 and BRCA2 is not for everybody, because if we offer expensive testing to lots of individuals for whom they're not going to benefit, our healthcare costs are eventually all going to go up. The circumstance is, however, different for ovarian cancer. Most people don't think about BRCA1 and BRCA2 for ovarian cancer, but we've now shown using hospital-based research, this is called the Malaysian Ovarian Cancer Genetic Study, we've been able to show that 1 in 9 ovarian cancer patients have a BRCA mutation. This is much higher than what it is in breast cancer. So in breast cancer, it's 1 in 20. In ovarian cancer, it is 1 in 9. This means that offering ovarian cancer patients genetic counseling and testing is really important. The circumstance has also changed because new data from ovarian cancer has now shown that the BRCA genes not only influence your risk of disease, it helps doctors to decide what treatment is appropriate for you. So we now know that at the molecular level, patients with BRCA mutations develop certain types of cancers. And the good news is that these certain types of cancers actually respond better to new therapies. So to platinum therapies, as well as to a new class of therapies that's called PARP inhibitors. These have only just been approved and the data is really exciting. There are a couple of PARP inhibitors that are out there, but this is really going to transform how it is that we're going to be able to treat ovarian cancer patients and perhaps in the future selected breast cancer patients and potentially even prostate cancer and pancreatic cancer patients more effectively. This is the future of cancer therapy. Being able to identify what genetic changes exist within the patient as well as within the tumour to select the right therapy for that patient.
What are the ethical guidelines of conducting clinical research? As you mentioned, you know, you want to make sure that the medications that are going out there, for instance, are of high quality. But when it comes to actually conducting these studies, getting these numbers, speaking to people, or sometimes even testing drugs on them, how do you... I mean, of course, it's an important step of the process. Nobody is denying that. But the ethical ramifications are gigantic.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a really important point, Trillian. I think there are two aspects of ethics within this particular study. Okay, so one aspect of the ethics is to make sure that when we are doing the study, to compare whether genetic counseling that's offered by non-geneticists but doctors, you know, like oncologists and gynae oncologists, is equivalent to genetic counseling that's offered by clinical genetic services. This is one ethical consideration. And for that one, you really need to make sure that the ethics committee approves this. So ethics committees are made up of doctors as well as patients that look at a proposal and see whether the rights of patients are protected, number one. They look at whether the study question is significant, because if it's not significant, the study shouldn't be conducted just on the willy-nilly whim of whoever the researcher is. Those two are very important considerations. So that's one aspect. Ethics is very important, and an appropriately constituted ethics committee needs to review a proposal. So in Malaysia, our proposal would have gone through the Malaysian Medical Research Ethics Committee, which is organized by the Ministry of Health, and it covers all of the Ministry of Health hospitals as well as the private hospitals. But in addition, for the individual hospitals that we work with, be it a university hospital or some private hospitals, they also have their own independent ethics committee. So our application would have gone through all of those as well. So that's one aspect of ethics. But the second aspect of ethics that relate to this specific trial deals with the ethics of providing genetic testing appropriately. I think one of my frustrations is that, you know, we have a lot of genomic medicine, and it's clear that genomic medicine is going to change how we approach the population. But the challenge is, how do we make sure that there's no genetic discrimination and people are appropriately informed? So for example, if a patient is tested because it might have an implication on her treatment, what happens is that if we now identify her as being a BRCA carrier, does that have implications on her insurance? Will the insurance turn around and say, oh, you were predisposed to this cancer and therefore it's a congenital disease and therefore you should not have access to treatment? I think that's unethical and that's wrong and that is not allowed for. But at the moment, the space is not clear. The guidelines are not clear. And then in terms of family members, when should family members get tested? If you are tested, what does that mean for your insurance? Again, the guidelines are not clear. We hope to be able to change this space. We're getting legal advice. We're getting lots of focus group discussions in place because clarity is absolutely required. If you're living in the US at the moment, you have the Genetic Non-Discrimination Act, which comes about, which basically means that if you have a genetic alteration, you cannot be discriminated against for insurance, for employability, and so on and so forth. In the Europe, as well as in Australia and New Zealand and other countries, they have a moratorium for insurers. This basically means that the insurers voluntarily say that as a consortium, they will not ask for genetic information. What's the circumstance in Asia? We've done a review of all of the insurance and the legal regulations in the Asia-Pacific region, and we know through our Asian consortium that essentially it's only in Japan and in Korea that there is clarity that genetic discrimination is not allowed. All other Asian countries currently do not have that. And this is really crying out as an attention that as an issue that requires attention. Because if we're going to be able to improve outcome for cancer patients, they need to be done in a setting that they're reassured that they're not going to be discriminated against.
I'm speaking today with Professor Dr. Teo Soo Hwang, CEO of Cancer Research Malaysia. We're discussing how long-term clinical research is conducted, particularly using the lens of the work that Cancer Research Malaysia is doing. Up next, we talk about the usual motivations of a participant, as well as the kind of counselling that is required. You are listening today to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. My guest today is CEO of Cancer Research Malaysia, Professor Dr. Teo Soo Hwang. We're talking about long-term clinical research and how it's conducted. So you spoke earlier of how Cancer Research Malaysia does it via partner hospitals and using very specific guidelines for who is appropriate to participate. But what are the usual motivations that you hear when someone agrees to participate? You know, and on the flip side of that, what are their worries?
I think for each of these different types of clinical studies, there are different motivations as well as different barriers. I think one of the things that I find absolutely amazing is, you know, we've been running cohort studies where we've had women volunteer for our research studies for a really long time. You know, like I said earlier, we now have 3,500 women who have donated not just their time to fill in our questionnaires, but their blood samples and their consent for us to do genetic research on their blood samples so that we can understand more about genetics and identify genes which are important in breast cancer. Why do these women do it? They do it because for them, cancer is, many people see cancer as something like, the first word often is death or no hope or fear, you know, or loss, financial catastrophe, all of the negative things. And they see research as a means of providing hope, not just for themselves, for someone in the future. So that becomes a very, very major motivator. People take part in research because it's very altruistic. Something that happened to them, they hope will not happen to their future generation or to other individuals. And that becomes a major reason why they contribute to research. Then moving forward in terms of clinical studies or clinical research, there are different types of clinical research. So for the MAGIC study, it is an observational cohort, which basically means that we're not giving them a drug that changes their treatment outcome. And for this, the barriers to doing the research is a little bit less because we are just taking their blood sample, we're doing some laboratory tests, and we're giving the results back to them. So for some, the motivator might be the same. It's an altruistic aim that they will help us achieve the goal that will help the outcome of the future, that they will be able to, by making that contribution, change the future outcome for cancer patients. But in addition, for this specific study, they get access to genetic testing that otherwise may not be available to them at a cost. So genetic testing in this country is currently available at a wide range of costs. Most of these are samples which are taken and then sent to overseas laboratories for testing. We've been able to use the test that we've developed in the research laboratory so that it's cost effective for patients. And for all patients taking part in the research study, the test is provided for free.
What are the worries then? So if people are, you know, they're interested in contributing in an altruistic manner, there surely have to be also people who are saying, well, I mean, earlier you spoke about, for example, all the genetic discrimination that could possibly happen. Are those concerns that come up?
They're absolutely major concerns that come up and very valid too. So I think this is where you conduct research and in the ethics and the governance of the research organisation is absolutely critical. So for an organisation like Cancer Research Malaysia, integrity is number one. So in terms of our core values, we have four core values: diligence, integrity, respect, and impactful. Conveniently spells DIRI, which is rather apt if you're thinking about core values. It spells yourself. But for us as an organization, integrity is number one. This means that patient rights come first. We protect patient confidentiality. We do not reveal results to anyone else outside of the study, no matter what the circumstances are. And for participants who are taking part in research studies, their doctors do not have to reveal the results to any other stakeholders. They do not have to reveal it to their insurers, to other payers, and so on. And in fact, they do not have to put those results into the medical records. Of course, on occasion, doctors have discussed it with the patients to decide together, is it appropriate to have it included in the results in the medical records, because it might help in terms of deciding future decisions. But that is a joined up decision. The whole point is, when you are taking part in research, your rights as a patient has to be protected.
What kind of information and counselling needs to be provided for the people participating? Because it can be a very complex world to negotiate, and it can be a very confronting thing to be told, look, you are a carrier of this, or this is what your genetic makeup is. And people misunderstand also what that means, you know, when someone says it's in your genes, for example.
You're absolutely right, Trillian. And the confusion is very real. That's because there are two types of genetic testing. One is a genetic test that tells you what genes you've inherited from your mother or your father, and you cannot change that. So no matter what you do, you cannot change that. There's no gene therapy available at the moment that allows us to do that. There are trials on new methods that are being developed, but at the moment, we can't change that. The second type of genetic test is where you're ordering that genetic test all of the time, because it tells you if you're estrogen receptor positive, you respond to an anti-hormonal drug like tamoxifen. So this is about treatment decisions. If you have a BRAF mutation, you respond to a BRAF inhibitor, and so on and so forth. That type of genetic test deals with a cancer genetic test. So for a cancer genetic test that relates to the cancer samples itself, then an oncologist, a treating cancer, a doctor can actually tell you the information, because that information is being used to guide your treatment and has got no implications on the rest of the family. The challenge is that some of the tests like BRCA1 and BRCA2 has value in that space. If you are a BRCA2, 1 or 2 carrier, we may choose a different treatment for you. Does that mean that what we should be doing is testing the tumour material? Because if we test the tumour material, we don't have to deal with the inheritance. It could just have happened in the tumour sample itself. And this is something that we're also going to be addressing within the research study. What is the more appropriate sample to be testing, so that we can introduce testing that helps patients, together with their doctors, decide on treatment options that doesn't deal with the risk one. But going back to the issue of risk, I think it's important that that family members are engaged with this whole process. I know certainly that when I give public talks, most of the time, the people who attend these public talks to try and raise awareness of cancer are either personally affected by cancer or have a family member affected by cancer. And getting good information there is absolutely critical. In that setting, I would be a very strong advocate to say that appropriately trained genetic counsellors need to provide that information. Because there's no reason why you need the test when you're 15 years old, for example. It's an adult onset cancer. There's no reason why you need the test in the same day, because it's not as if you're going to be able you to develop cancer overnight. You're not going to do that. So for unaffected individuals, rapid genetic testing doesn't make sense, because you need to have a considered response. You need to know, you know, what is your family history? Is genetic counselling appropriate for you? Have you got insurance? What implications that it have on your marriageability, on your children, and so on and so forth. So getting appropriate genetic counselling before you're affected by cancer is absolutely important. And in that context, then only you consider genetic testing. But for a cancer patient, it's different. When you already have cancer, then in that circumstance, it's about knowing whether that gene will influence what treatment your oncologist can give you. And therefore, perhaps it's a simplified form of genetic counselling that is necessary in that context. And that's what we're trying to address in the MAGIC study.
How does it impact your marriageability? I mean, with children, I guess I can kind of see that you worry about inheritance. In some cases, like with conditions such as thalassemia, of course, there is a call for genetic testing just to make sure that you don't have that problem. But marriageability?
You know, this comes from a lot of experience from our genetic counselors in reaching out and managing a lot of families. So we now have, you know, just under 200 families that we have managed and close to 400 patients, as well as unaffected men and women that we have counseled over time. And we find that sometimes breast cancer patients, you know, who are in their 60s, for example, they were diagnosed in their 40s, they've now survived breast cancer and they're in their 60s, and they've got children in their late 20s, and they're wondering, well, if I tell my daughter that she has a 50-50 chance of being a BRCA carrier, will it affect her ability or her desire to get married? If I'm telling my son that he also has a 50% chance, will it influence that? So given that the risk of cancer doesn't actually increase significantly until you're in your 30s, then some women decide that actually, I want to spare my children those decisions. Let them get married first so that I don't have to deal with my in-laws first. And then after that, we can decide what we do next.
So with genetic counselling then, is it often sort of a one-off process or should it be long-term? I mean, how does it enter at different phases?
That's an excellent question, Trillian. I think what happens with all of our families is that we follow them up over a really long period of time. I think what's important to know is that for most individuals, whether you are shown subsequently to be a carrier or not carrier, actually anxiety and worry decreases over time in a way that doesn't happen if you have a family member that's affected by cancer. Because if you're a family member affected by cancer, you always worry, am I going to be the next one? And you will carry that over time. Whereas if you know whether you're a BRCA carrier or not a BRCA carrier when you have a family member affected, then it gives you some certainty. It basically says that you're either 1 in 20 chance of developing breast cancer or potentially 80% chance. That means 4 out of 5 chance of developing breast cancer. And that gives you power to decide what should you do with it, you know, and it gives you appropriate power. That knowledge is really power to be able to do something impactful with.
We talked earlier about the importance of confidentiality, especially in terms of employability and insurance, things of that nature. It makes perfect sense that you don't want to go around telling everybody, well, I have a genetic predisposition. But in the case of a family physician, for example, maybe not your oncologist, because you might not be affected by cancer yet, but if you find out one way or the next, is that something that you should share with your primary care physician?
I think for risk management, at the moment, it doesn't involve a primary care physician. So our risk management clinics sometimes have got more doctors than they have patients.
Right.
And it's complex because for a woman, you want to make sure that you have a breast surgeon, you have a gynecologist or a gyne-oncologist, you have a radiologist, and you have the genetic counselor. And they are there to help you manage your risk of breast, ovarian, contralateral breast cancer, and to be able to think about what screening options are appropriate for you. Hence, the radiologist is there. If you are a man, you need to think about a urologist as well as a radiologist and think about whether you have a regular PSA test. And we've got research studies to show that men are at elevated risk of developing prostate cancer, and a regular PSA testing will help you be able to manage that disease and be able to detect the disease at an earlier stage. But in primary care, they may not be so well informed. I think certainly primary care has a major role in managing families and can help us as a community reduce the cost of medical care in this country. So very, very important role. But in terms of these rare syndromes, maybe it's still in tertiary care. Currently, we know that 1 in 400 to 500 individuals, healthy people, 1 in 4 or 500 healthy individuals have got a germline alteration, have inherited a alteration in BRCA1 or BRCA2, but the majority of those, 95% of those, currently don't know their status.
What criteria need to be met in order to have what you would consider an ideal study environment and a completely unsullied, you know, kind of perfect display of information?
Wow, that's a tough question, Trillian. I think that for me, like I said to you earlier, integrity is number one. I think if you are going to do any research study, you have to make sure that you deal with conflict of interest first. You know, why are you doing the research study? What's in it for you? And what's in it for the patient? And be clear with those motivators. For the majority of research studies, it's to specifically answer a research question. And hopefully that research question will make an impact on the management of patients overall. right? And that has to be really important. You have to make sure that it's approved by ethics committee, that patients get involved with that decision making of why they are involved. And then it really need to make sure that it results in an outcome. To me, integrity doesn't just extend to confidentiality of data. It also extends to making sure that you're doing research studies that are impactful. If you don't do research studies that are impactful, then you've wasted a lot of patients' time, you've dashed their hopes, and you've wasted a lot of doctors' time, ethics committee's time, and so on, and funding. You know, it's really critical that it results in something impactful.
And with so many areas to cover in medicine and in cancer, how do you prioritize which areas to focus on? I mean, there are a million and one things that we need more information on for new treatments, for different modalities. How do you decide on, okay, we will look at BRCA 1 and 2, for example, and take it from there?
I think for Cancer Research Malaysia, a lot of what we did in the beginning was very opportunistic. You know, we had to do what we could because we're still a tiny organization. I mean, if you look at how much we invest on cancer research or research in general in this country, it's abysmal. We spend 0.4% of our national GDP on research, right? In Singapore, it is 2.7%. In the UK, it's 3.something%. Our GDP is already small enough, and then we spend so little of it on research. So the reality is that we have to be very stringent at picking the things that we can make an impact on. So in the beginning, it was very opportunistic. If we can set up a cohort of breast cancer patients, ovarian cancer patients, then this is where we're going to go initially. But we've built on those foundations. So now that we have a larger cohort, we've also set up a tissue bank. From that tissue bank, we now know that the specific features of breast cancers in an Asian setting that suggest that they may respond better to immunotherapy. So we've discovered a genetic alteration that's present in about 50% of Asians, but only 10% of Europeans, and this might mean that therapies will work better here. So taking that step, we're now pushing to see whether we can organize those clinical trials here because we can bring more treatment options here. So I believe that cancer research in this country has got huge opportunity to grow. We need to make sure that, like the UK, in the UK, up to 15% of cancer patients are enrolled in clinical trials. This means that you are giving new hope for every single patient, that you have treatment options available for them that maybe under a trial setting, but that could change the future of how cancer patients are being treated. We're nowhere close to that at the moment, and step by step, we hope that we'll get there much faster, but we really need the public support as well as the government support to put funding in place to make sure that talented Malaysians come back and work in this area and that we continue to build partnerships to allow us to be more and more impactful in wider areas of cancer research.
So if there is so little funding, you know, in terms of the GDP for research as a whole, and Cancer Research Malaysia is also only getting a slice of that pie, obviously you have to start working with private partners. How do you keep your research interests separate from that and independent from private parties who maybe would have a vested financial interest?
I think we have several different sources of funding that we are looking at. I think it's been a fantastic contribution from our core donors. Yayasan Saim Dabi and Petronas and Yayasan Al-Bukhari have been our core donors that have supported us with no strings attached. So that means that even though they have private hospitals that are part of their subsidiaries, that's not a requirement for that collaboration. They fund us because we're a Malaysian organization trying to do impactful work to build a vision of a future free of the fear of cancer. And it's been fantastic to have that with us, right? But at the same time, we must diversify our income. And this is really where we have been pushing very aggressively over the past few years. So we've now got not only a very strong scientific advisory board that is built by experts from all over the world, from Cambridge Medical Research Council, Duke Cancer Centre, and so on, but we also have been starting to win international grants. So my group has recently won a Wellcome Trust Award that is worth £727,000 that will allow us to do more genetics research. We've won 3 out of the 12 Newton grants that are international grants offered by the British government in collaboration with the Malaysian government. And this will mean that we are able to compete internationally for research grants. This is important because oftentimes Malaysians are very skeptical. You know, kena, bolea. You sure Malaysian? Isn't it all brain drain? Well, we are here to say that we're not just doing research which is locally relevant. We need to compete internationally. But the third source of income is really members of the public. We've had an incredible bank of people who have been very generous in supporting us. I think one of the things we sometimes look at the UK and we think, the government must support all of the research in the UK. But actually, 40% of the, Cancer Research UK raises £1 million a day for cancer research. 40% of that comes from legacies. That means people who leave something for Cancer Research UK when they pass on. Another 40% of it comes from £10 donations. £10 donations. That means that what happens is that a lot of people feel that, yes, cancer research may be really expensive, but my £10 goes to an organisation that can make a difference, and my £10 can make a big part of the difference. Perhaps we need that to permeate the Malaysian consciousness. Then RM10 here might seem too little for expensive exercise like cancer research, but going to an organisation that has the integrity to be able to put it in impactful programmes and translate it to benefit cancer patients, perhaps is something that Malaysians can wake up to and ask, can I make a contribution? Will my RM10 go that much further?
Could you give us an example of how much it costs to run one long-term clinical study? So, how much has it been over the course of the years?
I think for the MAGIC study, it's going to cost, we're going to be recruiting about 800 ovarian cancer patients. It's a national study, which basically means it's open in 16 sites all the way from the north to the south, from Penang to JB, from Kuching to KK. So running a study like this is expensive. For 800 patients, we're talking about an investment of about RM1.5 million to be able to run that study. But other studies are even more expensive. So for example, we've been developing a type of immunotherapy, a way in which we can vaccinate oral cancer patients and nasopharyngeal cancer patients so that the cancer has a less chance of coming back. We're currently shown that this works in an animal model, and we are poised to be able to take it to the clinic. But it's going to take us RM6 to 7 million just to do that preclinical study. The model for cancer or any type of drug development is one in which the expensive part takes place in the laboratory and then in doing in the animal studies before you can test it first in humans. But those are absolutely critical before you can test them in humans because we need to make sure that the safety is assured. The challenge is this is now called a valley of death, that you are in an expensive point where nobody can fund you to bridge you to the point at which you can take a treatment like a vaccine all the way to treat head and neck cancer patients. Hopefully, we're working with the government. We hope to be able to get a grant that will get us there, but we also need to explore whether we can partner with the pharmaceutical industry to be able to get us there.
And finally, in real life, practical terms, how will research be used? I mean, just bring it home for us. You know, while you're dealing with numbers and information, how will this translate into impact for existing cancer patients, future cancer patients, people who are affected by cancer in some form or another?
If we do nothing, 1 in 3 Malaysians are going to get cancer by the age of 75, and 1 in 5 are going to die of cancer by the age of 75. And we already know that in a country like Malaysia, cancer is going to double between the year of 2012 to 2025, right? So the reality is that if we sit here and do nothing, we're going to face an increasing burden of cancer, an increasing cost of being able to treat cancers, and we're going to give treatments to not the right people, not at the right time. How are we going to do this? The only way we're going to do this is to find out more which patients benefit from which treatments and how do we bring the cost down to an affordable level. In addition, we're going to have to figure out how do we get Malaysians to become more healthy. And unfortunately, this is an area where we could be potentially pouring a lot of money for no effect, because it's not as if we don't know what the risk factors are, but we cannot get behaviours to change. So in my utopia, we need to build an environment in which we start to put research at the central part of our fight against cancer. It's not just about giving money to one cancer patient now. It's very deserving. It's not just about supporting one cancer patient now. Yes, that's very deserving. But if we only do that, we're going to face a very large bill in the future, one in which we're not prepared to deal with, and we don't have the infrastructure to deal with that. By investing in cancer research, in translational research, in clinical trials, all of these things will help us ensure that the future is different from what the reality is of today.
Thank you very much for coming in. I've been speaking with Professor Dr. Teo Soo Huang. She's the CEO of Cancer Research Malaysia. We've been discussing how long-term clinical research is conducted as well as why it's so important. You've been listening to Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.